From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn how the long history of protesting at UW-Madison is being documented and learn what students are doing there today. Then we'll learn about future plans for the large rotating powwow exhibit at the Milwaukee Public Museum, a tribute to survival.
It's a way to carry on our story, to keep telling our story that's not in a museum. So people are just excited that our voice, the Native voice, will continue somehow.
Plus, we'll learn what happens when an animal at the Milwaukee County Zoo dies.
The human-animal bond is something that it deeply affects everyone. They're taken care of in the same capacity, with the same concern as I would my dog or my cat.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Today is the start of a new season of Bubbler Talk. The topic might seem a little morbid, but we'll learn what happens to animals at the Milwaukee County Zoo when they die. We'll start with the student protests happening across the country and here in Wisconsin. Encampments have been set up at UW-Madison and UW-Milwaukee, where students are holding pro-Palestinian rallies and protesting university investments in Israel. On Wednesday, more than a dozen people were arrested at UW-Madison, but the protesters say that's not going to stop their efforts. Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez had this to say after the arrests.
So myself and President Biden and Governor Evers has been really clear. People have the right to protest. But also people have the right to be safe on campus. And so we want to make sure that it's an and, not an or, and that we're going to be supporting anybody that wants to be able to protest on campus safely and peacefully. So the police are coming in to just make sure that the laws are not being broken, but they are not saying that people cannot peacefully protest. They are there to, they can make sure that there's a safe environment on campus, but people can peacefully protest.
Student protests across the UW system are as old as the universities themselves. And one project is doing the work to archive that history, specifically at UW-Madison. It's called Sifting and Reckoning. It shares the history of student protests and uncovers the exclusion and violence towards marginalized groups on campus. Casey Lucchini-Butcher is the director of the Rebecca M. Blank Center for Campus History, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez about the project.
So there's a long history at UW and the UW system of having a politically active student body. Clearly today is no different as you're out on campus. And I'm wondering, what was the genesis of this project that you worked on?
The Public History Project came out of what I call the rediscovery of the presence of the Ku Klux Klan on campus in the 1920s. So in the 1920s, there were two student groups on campus that bore the name of the Ku Klux Klan. And following the violence in Charlottesville in 2017, Chancellor Rebecca Blank commissioned a committee of historians to study the Klan's presence on campus and report their findings. And in that report, there was kind of this, I think, a historian's question, which was, you know, it's great we know all this information about the Klan. What about everyone else? What about all the other histories of discrimination and resistance? So I was hired in 2019 to look into that exact question. What is the history of discrimination and resistance to discrimination at UW-Madison? And our goal was to make all of our findings very public. So we ended up doing a physical exhibit called Sifting and Reckoning, but we also did a digital exhibit website. So Sifting and Reckoning lives on at reckoning.wis.edu. We also did public lectures. We go to lots of classes. We put out a final report. All of this was really geared at how do we educate the campus community about the history of UW-Madison, and in particular, histories that we don't often want to talk about.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, that work was supported by leadership at the university. Can you talk about that a little bit? Like, what does it mean for an institution to be reflective and to sift and reckon with its history?
It's kind of hard to understate what a radical idea it is, right? For a university to critique itself. Universities are very obsessed with brand management and of telling very specific stories about themselves. And so to open up a project like the Public History Project and say, hey, tell us all the worst things about ourselves, the most complicated things about our past, I think that's a very radical act. And she definitely caught flack for it. There were definitely other leaders on campus who did not think that was the right decision. There were definitely people outside of the campus community who said, you know, why are you doing this? Why would you pay for that? But in my conversations with Chancellor Blank and with others on campus, she really said, you know, how are we going to make better decisions if we don't know about our past? If we don't know the full history, we can never move forward. And so she was like, you know, it's going to be hard. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be uncomfortable, but that doesn't mean it's not worth doing. And that's really an ethos we still take forward with us. We know that the histories we talk about are complicated and difficult. We know that they sometimes upset people's viewpoints about UW, but that doesn't mean they're not worth talking about. They are still a part of our history, whether we like it or not.
You know, I think so many Badgers have that story. Speaking for myself, coming from Milwaukee when I was on campus, I was shocked at the demographic in the early 2000s of the student body. I think it was over 80% white, a few Black and Latino students. And it was the first time I had heard racial slurs thrown around with such gusto. And I remember the hashtag the real UW was trending a few years back, and so many people from my era were coming forward and, you know, owning that history. What was the story behind that hashtag, and what did you hear?
Yeah, so we actually included that protest or that kind of protest movement in the Sifting and Reckoning exhibit, because when I had come to campus, that was still very fresh in people's minds. So that happened in 2016, and it was really a way for students to say, this is my kind of experience of UW that doesn't get documented, because it's not a specific UW problem. This is a history problem. We try and document these big moments in history, the flashiest moments, right? But what about the everyday occurrences for our students of color? Those are harder for us to get at. And so the real UW, I think, was an anecdote to that. It was a way for students to say, you know, my history, my story is not being covered in this way, but that doesn't mean that this isn't happening to other people. And I think what that showed as a movement was that, like, one story kind of toppled the next domino that toppled the next and toppled the next. And it was a way for students not only to share their experiences, but also to see their experiences mirrored back to them, right? You're not the only one experiencing these things, because I think there's a way where sometimes, you know, we're so desperate to not talk about uncomfortable histories that what ends up happening is we have a lot of students of color and other marginalized students who think that they're the only ones who have ever experienced this. And that's incredibly isolating.
Yes, absolutely. What you have here collected, I'm just looking at some of the tabs at the website, which is incredible. Earlier, student life, classroom, housing, athletics. There is a lot, enough for an art exhibition and, let's say, a robust digital archive. Is there anything in here that surprised you?
I mean, I think one of the things that was hard for me when I first got here is I was like, you know, how are we going to prove to people that racism has happened here, that discrimination has happened here? Because sometimes, you know, people have this deeply held viewpoint about UW in particular, that it's a liberal place, that it's a good place, and that kind of thing doesn't happen here. But instead, we kind of had the opposite problem. We found too many instances of discrimination and racism to include in the exhibit. And so we really had to start pulling back and saying, okay, what are these kind of exemplar moments, or what are the stories we really want to tell about this place? There were a couple, I think, themes that weren't surprising, but something that I thought was important to highlight, which is that students have been protesting since the beginning of UW. Our students are civically engaged. They're very, very active. They have a lot of political opinions and they love to express them. And that's political opinions on all sides, okay? Not even a spectrum. And so that was important for us to show. The other thing that was important for us to show is that some of the best parts of UW-Madison, the things that we look to as successes, the things that create belonging, that make students who are marginalized feel a part of this Badger community, were things that students demanded. Students know how to make the university better. It is often the administrators and university leaders who fail to listen to them.
And there's a line that you've highlighted in the study that says the university changes because students demand change, which I think speaks to that. And I was just curious, as you're out on campus today with the students around you, what are the demands that you're hearing from some of the protests and encampments on campus?
So I always teach my students, there's a quote from Frederick Douglass where he says, power concedes nothing without a demand. Because, yeah, you know, you need to ask for what you want to be different. I think universities, there's often a metaphor that universities are like a giant cruise ship. And so you can't really turn the ship quickly, right? You have to make these small movements over time. And our students are often the one who are making those demands or those asks of the university. Today, the students have a full list of demands that are available online. One of them is divesting from companies that support Israel, but they also have other concerns about housing, about cops on campus. They have a robust list of demands that come from their experience on campus and their desire to see a different campus community.
Hmm. And you talked about police on campus. That was one of the long histories that you all have archived, is the overly aggressive nature of UW police. And I am wondering in this time, as you're seeing across the country and some of these encampments are getting more violent with state repression, is how has the state or the university acted? Is there a history of repression of student voices?
The short answer is yes. There has always been some type of police response to student protests on campus. The varying degrees, I think, have really been different. So one of the ones that gets talked about the most is the Dow protests. They are sometimes called the Dow riots that happened. And not only was the Madison police and the university police involved, but the National Guard was called in. And what you have after this moment is all these very violent images coming out. I mean, we have images of like women being beaten with clubs, students being tear gassed and maced. And they're very violent images and very violent video. And they actually worked counterintuitively. So once people saw this video and these images, once people saw the crackdown, more students came out to protest. And we have oral histories from people who said, you know, I was just walking by going to class and I got tear gassed. And then they joined the protest the next day after kind of meeting that state violence head on. And so the crackdowns that universities envision on these protests usually have the opposite effect of what they want. And you can see that playing out right now on college campuses across the U.S. It happened at Columbia. It happened at UT Austin. Right. You can pick an example. The more harsh the crackdown, the more students, faculty, and staff who show up the next day, because it's not a good thing to see. You don't want to see your campus community exercising their right to free speech and then meeting police violence. Sometimes UWPD in our history has not responded. They've just let students protest and kind of been there in case something pops up. And generally speaking, the protests happen, students will negotiate with the administration, and then the protests will fizzle out once demands are met or once there's a kind of an action plan for change on campus. And so this idea that somehow to keep campus safe, we have to escalate, that there has to be a police response, I think that that response and that plan of action has often worked opposite of what the university wants. It has usually increased protests.
Mm-hmm. I'm also thinking about, with everything that's happening today, is that you will have a lot of work to do to archive. Mm-hmm. I kind of think about then what comes next. And I'm wondering that for you, what comes next for this project? What comes next for your team's work? What comes next when it comes to really storing some of this history from our university system?
We're first eternally grateful to student journalists. So we utilized in our project student journalism from every single decade, pretty much. And so the student journalists who are out here are really like kind of eyes and ears on the ground, and they document these protests from so many angles. And so that's going to be hugely beneficial. But us as a center, in collaboration with the university archives, we try and collect as much as we can. So, you know, we've already collected flyers that have been handed out by the university administrators, by the protesters. We're going to collect some of the protest signs and preserve those. Because we do try and collect in the moment. And we really want to make sure that this is going to be documented, especially because it is part of this bigger national movement. And so people will want to talk about this. So on the ground, we're trying to document as much as possible and to really get students to think of documenting themselves. So students often don't think of themselves as historically important enough. And so we want to kind of empower them to think like, hey, in 50 years, people will want to know how you guys organized and how you talked to one another and how you came up with your demands, things like that. As far as the center broadly, so the reason that we're out here today is that we are here to not only document the history of the university, but to share the history of the university with our campus community. And so, you know, we will continue to do that work, not only researching the university's past, but making it accessible to the public. And right now, that includes talking a lot about our rich history of student protest.
Casey Lucchini-Butcher is the director of the Rebecca M. Blank Center for Campus History at UW-Madison. She spoke with Like Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez. You can find more coverage of the student protests at WUWM.com. Later in the show, we'll learn what's going to happen with a large rotating powwow exhibit at the Milwaukee Public Museum when they move locations. But first, we'll hear some of WUWM's new podcast, Swing State of the Union, which explores why Wisconsin is so important in U.S. politics. That's coming up on Like Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Like Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Wisconsin is among a handful of states that will choose the next U.S. president. It's a familiar story for us in Wisconsin, which is a perennial swing state. But what is it about the state that makes us so purple? Why are politics so tightly divided here, and what can we learn about politics in Wisconsin to better understand our nation? WUWM's new podcast, Swing State of the Union, is attempting to answer those lofty questions. It launched this week and can be heard on air tomorrow at noon. But before that, we're giving you a sneak peek of what's in store.
Wisconsin matters not just because it's an election year, but because the state has historically reflected and predated national trends. Here's 100 years of history in about 15 minutes.
The year is 1911. It will still be another 3 years before the start of World War I, and Germany and Russia are still ruled by monarchs. There are only 46 states in the United States, as Alaska, Hawaii, Arizona, and New Mexico are still territories, and a 22-year-old Charlie Chaplin is just getting started in vaudeville. And in Wisconsin, a new idea was being tried for the first time in America, the state income tax.
Previously, states primarily raised revenue through either tariffs, a tax on imported or exported goods, and excise taxes. That's a tax on specific items like alcohol, tobacco, or sugar. The federal government did tax income briefly to pay for the Civil War, but the tax was repealed soon after, and future attempts were ruled unconstitutional. The 16th Amendment, which allowed the federal government to tax income, wasn't ratified until 1913, 2 years after Wisconsin had instituted its own income tax.
Ringling Brothers, yes, the carnival company, was among those who lobbied against the tax, threatening to move their headquarters out of their Baraboo, Wisconsin home because of it. But business interests in Wisconsin didn't hold the political power they had in other states, as Wisconsin was led by a coalition of progressives and socialists, whose political base was largely made up of farmers and industrial laborers who didn't hold much sympathy for the business class. As John Gerda, Milwaukee author and historian, explains, Wisconsin's Progressive Party, led by Fightin' Bob La Follette, was popular among rural farmers, as they were looking to take a stand against railroad companies who exploited the farmers' need to transport their goods to market.
They were considered kind of these bloodsuckers, you know, who were just bleeding farmers, especially dry. You know, they tried to get their crops to market, and the railroads really held them up. So there was competition on the lakeshore because there were so many ports, but the monopolies they had inland, it cost more to ship grain from, say, Hudson, northwestern Wisconsin, down to Milwaukee than it would from Milwaukee to Buffalo. So there was a real an openness to railroad reform, and La Follette just rode that. You know, that was really one of his principal campaign planks.
While progressives were popular in rural areas, it was the socialists who were popular among urban industrial labor. Like in many major American cities, Milwaukee's industrial workers organized around poor working conditions. Milwaukee workers shed blood for these ideals. We'll learn more about the Milwaukee socialists in later episodes. But the income tax was here to stay, both in Wisconsin and nationally. In 1932, during the Great Depression, Wisconsin progressives were the first in the nation to institute state-funded unemployment insurance. 2 years later, political scientists at the University of Wisconsin developed a plan for state-funded Social Security. By 1935, the Social Security Act made these Wisconsin innovations national law, and they became the core pillars of the Democratic Party's New Deal coalition, formed under President Franklin Roosevelt.
The socialist platform and a lot of its rhetoric was co-opted by the Democrats. You know, Social Security in 1935, that was a socialist idea called old age insurance.
But about a decade later, in 1946, political winds had shifted. World War II had just ended, and the Soviet Union and the threat of global communism dominated American politics. In Wisconsin, the Progressive Party was dead. And though the movement had grown out of the Republican Party decades earlier, Wisconsin socialists and progressives were defecting to the Democrats. Meanwhile, the Republican Party was nominating a firebrand from Appleton, Wisconsin, Joseph McCarthy.
They shouldn't be called Democrats. They should be referred to properly as the Commie Crap Party.
McCarthy had been a Democrat until 2 years before this election. And though initially he was not as vocal about communism, by 1950 he had found his political niche. His name became synonymous with anti-communism as he relentlessly hunted supposed communist agents in the federal government. His crusade and tactics, now known as McCarthyism, drew the ire of his colleagues in the Senate, as well as U.S. Army Special Counsel Joseph Welch, who claimed McCarthy recklessly accused members of the Army of being communist agents without ever providing proof of espionage.
You have done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?
But McCarthy's message resonated with Wisconsin voters, and he was reelected in 1952. In his second term, he continued his rhetoric before being censured in 1954 and dying in office just 3 years later.
And in the decade after McCarthy's death, Wisconsin would yet again shape national law. The Great Migration had made its way to Milwaukee, and by 1967, the promise of unionized industrial labor had attracted more than 80,000 black people mainly to Milwaukee's north side. Milwaukee's south side, populated primarily by Polish immigrants and their families who came to work in the city's factories around the turn of the 20th century, were openly hostile to black people and favored the segregated status quo.
But as Milwaukee historian Reggie Jackson explains, Milwaukee proper and suburbs surrounding Milwaukee allowed covenants explicitly prohibiting the sale or rental of homes there to anyone who wasn't white.
16 of the 18 suburbs within Milwaukee County used racial covenants for a number of years. These covenants were written from the early 1900s through the 1950s, even 10 years after the Supreme Court ruled that they were unenforceable. People continued to write them. They were very effective tools in keeping cities, towns, villages as white as possible, because that was the purpose of them, was to keep people of color out. And they were very, very effective.
When Alabama governor and segregationist leader George Wallace visited the south side of Milwaukee in his 1964 campaign for president, he received a warm welcome.
And I want to say to you here that I'm very grateful to you, and there'll always be a warm place in my heart for the people of Milwaukee and of Wisconsin. And as I said the other night, if I ever have to leave Alabama, I'll come to the state of Wisconsin, because I know.
But for 200 nights, anti-segregationists led by Milwaukee's NAACP Youth Council marched across the city, including the 16th Street Viaduct known as Milwaukee's Mason-Dixon Line, all to protest segregation despite the slurs, threats, and violence that awaited them. And among those marchers was Vel Phillips, the first black alderperson and the first woman alderperson in Milwaukee. She kept the pressure on the otherwise all-white, all-male common council to pass legislation to outlaw racial discrimination in housing.
Nobody is free until everybody is free, and we intend to march, all of us, until we get just some of the basic freedoms that are ours.
Phillips first proposed a fair housing bill in Milwaukee in 1962. She was the only vote in support. 3 years later, Wisconsin would sign its own watered-down version of a fair housing bill that excluded the majority of the housing stock in Milwaukee. In 1968, the Federal Fair Housing Act was passed in Congress, which mirrored Phillips' initial proposal.
The Civil Rights Act of 1968. Included in the measure was a landmark open housing bill, which, when fully effective, would forbid discrimination in approximately 80% of all housing offered for rent or for sale in the United States.
Fair housing for all human beings who live in this country is now a part of the American way of life.
But while President Johnson and the Milwaukee marchers hailed the Fair Housing Act for the victory it was, economic forces would soon undermine its lasting material impact.
Milwaukee, like industrial towns across Wisconsin and the nation, would soon feel the effects of a changing economy. Starting in the 1970s, deindustrialization, or the process of transitioning out of an industrial economy struck at the heart of Milwaukee. Good-paying jobs that supported a Black middle class within the city left or were eliminated altogether. At the same time, many middle-class white Milwaukeeans moved to the suburbs, taking their tax dollars with them. This left a city that was hardly recognizable by the 1990s. Reggie Jackson grew up in Milwaukee in the 1970s and early 80s, before graduating high school and joining the Navy. When he returned to the city a decade later in the early 90s, he could hardly believe what had happened to his hometown.
The Black median family income in 1970 was the seventh highest for Blacks anywhere in the country. And Black people were making the equivalent about $50,000 in today's money for family median income versus what the real median income is today is about $30,000 for a Black family. A huge drop off in the condition of Blacks. And that's primarily because of the good family supporting wage jobs and manufacturing that brought Black people to Milwaukee have primarily disappeared and been replaced by service sector jobs. So when you look at the growth of jobs in Milwaukee, there's been a huge growth in low-paying service sector jobs that have, in many respects, taken the place of family-supporting wage manufacturing jobs that brought, you know, many people's parents and grandparents to Milwaukee from the 1940s through the 1970s and early 80s.
We'll return to the effects of deindustrialization in Wisconsin in a later episode. But something else had also changed, the discourse. In the 1990s, Wisconsin's and the nation's political winds had shifted back to the right. Conservative talk radio emerged as a dominating rhetorical force, personified by people like Rush Limbaugh. Charlie Sykes was there as this movement took place in Wisconsin, hosting his own conservative show on Milwaukee area station WTMJ. Sykes believes the popularity of his show in Wisconsin and the popularity of the talk radio format nationally was due to conservatives feeling left out of the national conversation.
When I started, talk radio was really not a major force. The Fairness Doctrine had been repealed in the late 1980s, and AM radio was sort of like an abandoned strip mall. Nobody was doing anything there. And so when people like Rush Limbaugh and others came in, I don't think anybody could have quite seen what the trajectory was going to be. And I started in 1992, 1993, and turning on the radio and hearing, you know, conservative ideas taken seriously was like pouring water into parched earth because they had not been getting this.
As the 90s turned to the 2000s and the 2010s, Sykes says he grew concerned with the effect his medium was having on political discourse.
We had been so successful in criticizing the bias of the mainstream media that we had succeeded in destroying the credibility of all of the fact-based media. And it became impossible to penetrate that. And as a result, many conservatives had lost their immunity to bad information. So, and I think that you saw this happening in Wisconsin, perhaps before the rest of the country. The other pivot point, of course, was the fight over Act 10, where I think the lines were drawn much more intensely than they ever had been before. I mean, if you want to look at a real inflection point, you have to go back to 2010 and 2011, you know, post-Tea Party, when in fact, a lot of the divisions that we've seen nationally were vividly on display in Wisconsin, and I was certainly part of that.
As Sykes alludes to, he also succeeded in putting Wisconsin Republicans on the map again. In 2011, a century after Wisconsin's progressive and socialist coalition made it the first state to institute an income tax, Reince Priebus, a Wisconsin Republican, was chairman of the Republican National Committee. Paul Ryan, a Republican from Janesville, was a rising political star, soon to be tapped as the GOP's vice presidential nominee in 2012. And Scott Walker, a Wisconsin Republican, was in the national spotlight after passing Act 10, a landmark bill that Walker claimed would cut costs by banning public sector unions from collectively bargaining on anything other than wage increases at the rate of inflation. Fire and police unions would be the only exception to this ban.
In 100 years, Wisconsin had gone from passing a progressive income tax to slashing state budgets, all while setting national trends in social security, anti-communist rhetoric, civil rights, and mass media communication.
You just heard a sneak peek of the first episode of Swing State of the Union, WUWM's new politics podcast. You can hear the full episode at WUWM.com or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also tune in tomorrow at noon right here on 89.7 WUWM. It might be a little morbid to think about, but a Bubbler Talk listener wanted to know,
what happens to the bodies of the animals that die at the Milwaukee County Zoo?
We'll find out in about 15 minutes. But first, we'll learn what makes the Milwaukee Public Museum exhibit A Tribute to Survival so unique, and what it still has to offer. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. One of Milwaukee Public Museum's best-known exhibits is A Tribute to Survival, which opened in the fall of 1993. The centerpiece of this exhibit is a giant turntable that rotates 37 life-size figures that recreate a powwow grand entry. With the museum scheduled to move to a new site in 2027, many questioned what would happen to this exhibit, especially the people who helped to create it. When Carol and Diane Amore discovered that the Tribute to Survival exhibit did not make it to the plans to move to the new museum location, they started an effort to work with the museum to make sure the exhibit could have a future to continue to teach new generations. Carol and Diane join me now to share more about their plans for the exhibit moving forward. Carol begins by sharing her initial reaction to learning about the museum's plan to move.
I was very saddened, probably horrified, because we had said initially that this was an exhibit, a forever exhibit, that was being built to pay tribute to the tribes of Wisconsin and to the Native people of Wisconsin. And it still has so much to teach, and so many of those models are still here with us. And so, you know, why should that tribute stop? It's still very important, and we still have so many things to learn from it. So that's pretty much how I felt.
How about for you, Diane?
My first reaction was a question: is the exhibit going to move with the museum? And then as we learned more and we found that it was not going to move, they started asking questions about what should happen to the exhibit itself, to the figures. And then I started to worry about, like, well, where are they going to go? Are they going to put them in storage, or are they going to break them up, or what was going to happen? So mine were basic questions, and then we started a dialogue with the museum.
So before we get into that dialogue with the museum about the future plans for the Tribute to Survival exhibit, I want to go into how this exhibit was made and curated by the whole community and what makes it unique. So typically, museums have historians, anthropologists putting their exhibits together, but how was Tribute to Survival unique in how it was made?
Well, there are a lot of ways that it was unique, but probably one of the biggest was that from the get-go, once we started working on the exhibit, the museum, and I say we because at that time I was an employee of the museum, but we reached out to the Native community in Milwaukee with the idea of inviting as much participation as possible in terms of how things were said and how the exhibits looked and who should be the models and how we should go about reaching out. So at that time, that was pretty unusual because that was back in the late 80s. The exhibit had really been inspired by Indian Summer in Milwaukee. And I think that's kind of what got museum people talking about it first and looking for grants. And they got a very big grant to do the exhibit. So immediately started reaching out. And that was very unique.
So from the get-go, a whole collaborative process with hundreds of tribal members across Wisconsin. And for you, Diane, you were involved in the beginning as well. Do you recall what that first meeting or the first initial meetings were like with the Milwaukee Public Museum about 35 years ago?
I do. One of the people who came was Nancy Lurie, who is an anthropologist from the museum. And she had a relationship with some community members already because she taught classes at the university and was involved with Native community throughout the years. So when she first came, I have to say that we were kind of worried, like, why are we going to help a museum? You know?
Yeah, speculation, like, right, like trepidation.
Right,
yeah.
Because like as you said, anthropologists and historians set things up from their point of view. And so in this case, they came and asked for us to be at the table right away and that we would have a voice in how it would proceed. So in choosing the models, for instance, we decided to try to choose people who look different, not look like an Indian looks, and also that there be representation from the different tribes in Wisconsin.
And these were real people that were used for the models, which I think is so cool. I did not know that before this. I've gone to the museum all these years, and I think that attention to detail is so great and unique. And there's also some other things that were priorities for the group making a tribute to survival. So can you share some of the other behind-the-scenes production that went into this that, you know, the day-to-day visitor might not think of and know?
I think a very important story or interesting story is the first time we had what then was called a general counsel at the museum. And there were several planned, and anyone from the Native community in the state was invited to come and have a say, have a voice in how we were proceeding. And the plan had been that the figures were going to be behind glass on that turntable, that it was going to be totally glass enclosed. Well, right away you think that's like museums. Everything is put behind glass. And then immediately that makes it look like from the past. You know, it makes it look like it's not going forward or there, you know, it's not alive and well here right now. Outfits from the museum's collection were going to be used. And that was one of the reasons that it was going to be behind glass. So anyway, we had the first general council meeting and there was an opportunity for people to speak. And one of the first people from the Native community that stood up to speak said, "Why are you going to put us behind glass? You said you want to do an exhibit that shows that we're still here and that our culture is alive and thriving and has survived all of these government efforts to make us assimilate. So you want to put us behind glass?" And then person after person, you know, said that. And the conservators, of course, expressed great concern, saying it couldn't be out in the air because you have to protect the outfits and so forth. Well, at that point, which I just think is a real exciting moment in the story, the head of exhibits and design stood up and said, "Well, I have an idea for this. We won't use the outfits from the collection. We'll have all the outfits made by Native people in the state. So then it doesn't have to be behind glass." And there was, you know, a lot of discussion about that. And then that's what happened. Oh, and then the other thing he said was, "And Carol Ann will gather all the outfits." So, which turned out to be great because I got to travel all over the state and meet people from all the tribes. It was, what an opportunity, you know, what an honor.
As you mentioned, it was an open call to action to invite everyone in to have input. And one major group that plays a factor in this project and beyond is the American Indian Advisory Council in Milwaukee. So, Diane, can you speak to what their goal was during the time in the late 80s when they were involved in this process as well?
We decided to form a group because many things were happening in Milwaukee, like construction and different things. And we were never at the table. We were never invited. And in fact, our population is so small, we're always statistically insignificant. So we're small, and so lots of times people don't even recognize that we're here. And one of our goals was to be more visible in the community. So therefore, when they came, we thought this was an opportune time, a win-win situation for us. But then again, that concern about, you know, museums. So after a discussion, we decided that we would endorse that and therefore it could go forward. And so a lot of, like I said, the figures, the models were chosen by people from this area and people who lived in this area.
That's amazing. And Remind me, Carol, you said this took about 5 years to put this together, right?
Yes.
So for the both of you, so you were working for the museum at the time.
Correct.
And Diane, you were involved as a member of the American Indian Advisory Council and as a resident here in Milwaukee. So over the course of the 5 years, what stands out to you? Like, what do you think went well? What were some bumps in the road? Do you feel like overall it was a satisfactory process?
Well, Carol is much more involved actually than I was, but from the beginning I thought it was because we were able to choose who is going to help write the script with Carol. People would volunteer, people who had a really good background of our own history. In general, I think it was a very good process. They involved us, you know, like we got to go shopping at powwows and buy part of the outfits. My own mother made many pairs of moccasins that are there now. So now I go look and I can pick them out. So it's, to me, it was a fulfilling experience. And seeing that come alive or be a different kind of exhibit. I think a lot of our people in our community, when they go there and see the exhibit, feel, oh, there we are. Here we are. So in that way, it's really good.
So as you both have been hitting upon, the importance of a tribute to survival and its legacy, its roots, but also its longevity is still needed today, especially for the educational value for people both in the Milwaukee area and beyond. So with the plans for the museum closing this location and moving to a new one and not taking this exhibit intact with it, what are the plans to make sure that a tribute to survival is not simply moved? What's happening now? What are you working on today?
Well, after Diane and I talked with Katie Sanders at the museum, and a shout out to her, she really has been cooperative and supportive. And once she kind of understood some of the things we were looking at doing, has been more than helpful. We've worked with the museum, and they've signed an agreement with us, with our tribute documentary group, so that we can produce a documentary about the making of tribute. And we're hard at work on that already. We're starting, you know, to fundraise so that we can do this. And what's terrific is that from that beginning and that signing off of the museum in December, they've now created a working group at the museum to help us. We've also talked about, after we finish the documentary, that we'll do like a virtual tour so that kids in schools or, you know, anyone can continue to tour that exhibit. But then finally, when it's time for the exhibit to move, that for those figures that don't go someplace else, and maybe you could talk about that a little bit, Diane, that they will share with us the rest of the exhibit so that we can find a new home for it. That'll be the next step. But the idea, again, would be that those stories could continue to be told, and it could even become beyond tribute. So we would add in stories from all the tribes about all the things that have been done in the last 35 years and will be done in the next 100. So pretty exciting, the possibilities. But maybe you want to talk a little bit about, Diane, the figures, how that's going to work.
Yeah. Some of the figures are of people who have walked on. And some of those families don't want their relative to be there anymore. And some people are going to actually take their own figures if they can, if they let them. But like, for instance, one person I know, the female veteran in the exhibit, she's asked that her figure goes to the Veteran Historical Society Museum, and they've accepted that offer. There's a couple of the figures that the museum wants to use and repurpose within their collections. So different things will happen with them, but as Carol said, we wanted to keep using them to tell stories, to show progress within our communities.
Yeah, so much more to build on, as you're saying. So with the start of this exhibit being a collaboration, and now with this new phase of the exhibit also being collaborative, despite the fact that it's ending at the museum as we know it now, what are you looking forward to for its future?
There's a couple things. One of the things is that this group that we talk about, the tribute documentary group, there's so many people who have signed on to be part of it in different ways. Some people are really involved in, like, you know, fundraising or decision making. That's one of the things. The other thing is it's a way to carry on our story, to keep telling our story that's not in a museum. So people are just excited that our voice, the Native voice, will continue somehow.
Keying off of that, I think that fact to see how people are coming together. Mm-hmm. And also you had asked about, you know, our titles, and that we're really trying to do this in an indigenous way as well. You know, we have different groups because some are focusing more on fundraising and some are focusing on, you know, other things. But that, you know, it's consensus. We all have a voice and we all work together. And it's also very exciting to bring it into, you know, life today and looking forward. Mm-hmm. So that it's not just being, you know, held at a certain moment in time.
Carol Amore was a script writer for A Tribute to Survival and is the administrative assistant for the Tribute Documentary Group. Diane Amore is a member of the Prairie Band Potawatomi Tribe and a member of the Tribute Documentary Group as well. You can find out more information about the project at WUWM.com.
Bubbly Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM's Excaret Nunez. Every day, thousands of people visit the Milwaukee County Zoo to see the animals they love. Whether it's the adorable otters, roaring tigers, or giant elephants, these animals live their lives on display. But most of us don't know what happens after they die. That prompted Bubbler Talk listener Terry Puick-Sandberg to ask,
what happens to the bodies of the animals that die at the Milwaukee County Zoo?
To find out, I took a trip to the zoo to meet Tim Wild, the zoo's large mammal curator.
Well, the first thing we do is we call the vet staff. You know, they come down, they confirm everything that we know. And
he says every animal that meets its end at the zoo is required to get a necropsy. Necropsy is just a fancy word for animal autopsy. And the smallest to biggest creatures you can think of get one, from starfish to giraffes. They're transported to the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine.
This is our necropsy facility. As you can hear with the echo, it's cavernous, like a gymnasium.
That's David Gasper. He's a veterinary anatomic pathologist who performs necropsies on zoo animals from across Wisconsin. He searches for clues about the animal's health, a sort of disease detective.
So we do a complete external physical exam, just like your veterinarian would when you bring your dog in. Head to tail, so everything gets measured and described, and then we'll do an internal examination.
Next, they preserve parts of the animals on slides to get a closer look.
We try to match up what we found, and every one of those changes, whether it's normal or abnormal, you know, it could be an age-related change, or it could be a tumor, or it could be an abscess, all of those things we look at under the microscope. This giant microscope sitting next to us is where I spend three or four times as much time as I do doing the necropsies.
Gasper says what veterinary pathologists find can be used to improve the care of living animals both in the zoo and in the wild. After the necropsy is done, Gasper says there are four different ways an animal's remains can be disposed of. There's cremation, burial on zoo grounds, composting, and something called alkaline digestion. A quick warning that this next part is a bit graphic.
Alkaline digestion is a process where we put the remains into a lye solution under high pressure, and it dissolves pretty much everything except the bones. And the bones at the end of the day are basically dust, essentially a giant instant pot with lye.
Gasper says the digester is used in particular to destroy things like an elephant's ivory tusks or a tiger's teeth, which poachers might try to find. The Milwaukee County Zoo also doesn't publicly disclose burial sites to prevent poaching. The zoo doesn't hold memorial services for the animals, but Gasper says they're still mourned. He says he creates keepsakes for zookeepers by taking paw or hoof prints of nearly every animal that comes for a necropsy.
The human-animal bond is something that it deeply affects everyone. They're taken care of in the same capacity with the same concern as I would my dog or my cat. And so these are important things to give back.
Tim Wild with the Milwaukee County Zoo says an animal's remains continue educating people.
The UW Zoological Museum takes a lot of the skeletons for their collection for educational reasons there. We might bring horns or antlers or part of the hides back. There's a lot of samples that might go to researchers throughout the country. So there's lots of different ways that that animal can continue to help educate not just us, but people all over.
Bubbler Talk listener Terry Puick-Sandberg says she's surprised to learn about all the work that happens after an animal dies at the zoo.
I got far more information than I ever thought was going to be possible.
Like I said, I thought it was just, I put them on a truck and off they go somewhere. I had no idea there were all those different ways. I had no idea about the necropsy. I had no concept.
So the next time you go to the zoo, take a moment to appreciate not just the living animals in front of you, but all that happens behind the scenes when they're gone.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from UW Credit Union. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
Bubbler Talk wraps up Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, Excret Nunez, and Jimmy Gutierrez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Robert Larry. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Taryn Powell, Lena Tran, and Mayon Silver from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Villegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at wuwm.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon when we'll explore the surge in traffic deaths in Milwaukee County and possible solutions. Plus, we'll meet a 72-year-old working on her bachelor's degree at UW-Milwaukee. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.